The challenge today for me is I've elected to work on two different individuals. Most of the time when we're doing speakers and we're talking about stuff, it's a one person or a one event type of a thing. And I opted to do two, both because I couldn't decide which of the two I really wanted to do the most, but also because there's so much interlap and similarity between the two. And it's exciting, and I don't know how much everybody knows about both Thomas Kane and Alexander Donovan, but they're both fascinating individuals. And there's a lot of similarities. So let me first of all just talk about some similarities and then some differences about the two, and then I'm going to talk primarily, go to Alexander Donovan first, and then finish up with Thomas Kane. And I do have a lot of material to cover. I'm going to try to do it rapidly. So if you've got questions, let's try save for the end, see how much time we've got. I'm happy to try to answer as many as I can, and likewise stick around afterwards if anybody would like to. So time period, they're both in the same time frame. Okay, Alexander Donovan, he lives from 1808 to 1887. Thomas Kane is 1822 to 1883, so they're contemporaries. Very likely, since they were both well-known individuals in their lives, they probably heard about each other quite a bit. As far as I can tell, they never met. They came really close. They came really close because there's a point, and we'll talk about Mexican-American War, the Mormon Battalion, and so forth here in just a minute. But Thomas Kane had this idea that he was going to start the Mormon Battalion and go with them, and eventually he had his eye on maybe getting appointed to be the governor in California. And he's going to go out with General Kearney out to California. And had that happened, they would have gone right through Santa Fe, which is where Alexander Donovan and his troops are going to meet. And so he meets the Mormon Battalion. But as we'll see, Thomas Kane wasn't there because he took seriously, gravely ill and stayed in winter quarters. They both came from families of prominence. Both were well-educated. Both of them in their 30s married teenage girls. Both those girls were named Elizabeth, interestingly. Both were lawyers, both were politicians, both financially well off. They both were at different times colonels and generals in military situations. Both were war heroes. Both of them were famous for having traveled thousands and thousands of miles on various expeditions that they were involved in. They both had extensive legacies, both while they were alive and then since, that you can find all over. Gary mentioned Kane, Pennsylvania is one of them. And so Thomas Kane has many things named after him. Alexander Donovan, likewise, many things named after him. Both were individuals who had very strong convictions. Both strongly believed in freedom, individual rights, the U.S. Constitution, freedom of religion, rights of others, particularly minorities, and standing up for those, even at the peril of their own lives at times. The result of that is that they both figured prominently in American history, and particularly on the U.S. frontier, and they both were interwoven with the history, early history of the Mormon Church, and became revered in the Mormon Church because neither of them were Mormon. And yet they both were ardent defenders of the Mormon faith and the ability of people to have their freedom of religion, even though they were a very unpopular and very persecuted minority at the times that they were being defended. Now, there were differences, too. One of the ones strikingly physically is that Thomas Kane was small in stature, 5'4", 5'4", dark hair. Alexander Donovan, to the contrary, 6'4", and a ginger. He was redhead, okay? And was a very prominent figure in the courtroom as a result. Alexander Donovan was a Southerner, was a slave owner. Thomas Kane, a Northerner and an abolitionist. Okay. Alexander Donovan had two children, both of whom tragically die in their teenage youth. On the other hand, Thomas Kane has four children, all of whom live long lives, three doctors and an engineer. Alexander Donovan was a soldier in the 1838 Mormon War, whereas Thomas Kane was the mediator who helped solve the 1857-58 Utah War. Donovan refused to fight on either side in the Civil War. Thomas Kane was a Northern colonel who became a war hero for fighting for the North in the Civil War. Alexander Doniphan was elected 3 times to the Missouri State Legislature. Thomas Kane, on the other hand, was never elected, never ran for office, but had been schmoozing, and his father had been schmoozing with presidents and cabinet members for years, and so he was on a first-name basis with most of the presidents of the United States and could basically get their attention whenever he wanted. As I mentioned, they almost crossed paths, but probably only heard and knew about each other. It would be very interesting to find out what their respective opinions of each other were, because there was so much positive and negative in the presses. And there were times when both were lauded, and ultimately in history we'll look back and say that they were very popular overall, but there were times when there were lots of people after them, and in fact their lives being threatened. So a lot of interesting things with both of them, comparing and contrasting, but let's talk about each one individually. So I want to talk first of all about Alexander Doniphan, and I'll give you a little bit of background, and then we'll talk about some of the significant events in his life, and then likewise do the same with Thomas Kane. So Doniphan was born in Kentucky, and this was in 1808. Both of his grandfathers served as soldiers in the American Revolutionary War. His father was a personal friend of Daniel Boone in Kentucky, and was had a lot of experience with him on the frontier. But Doniphan, being the youngest of 10 children, had the misfortune that his father, who was the friend of Daniel Boone, died when he was only 4 years old. So his mother was raising essentially 10 kids. Fortunately, again, they were well off. He was sent to Augusta College, where he studied law. Big influence in his life was there was a professor there by the name of Henry Bascom, who was a Methodist preacher, a very pulpit-pounding, fire and brimstone type of a preacher, but also a man of great moral integrity. And he was one of Doniphan's heroes. And so he learned to be a great orator from listening to this preacher, and also got a lot of his moral compass from the gentleman. And as I said, 6'4", ginger, very impressive. In those days, of course, the average height was a little lower than it would be today, and so if somebody who was 6'4", definitely stood out and got noticed. As a lawyer, he had all types of cases. He didn't specialize, like we were talking about. You know, we've got, you know, probate, and we've got corporate, and we've got litigation, all these things. When you were a lawyer on the frontier, you did anything, basically. Whatever the case was, he handled it, which he did ably for many years. He had the experience that many did where they traveled. They were kind of on a circuit. They would move from, you know, settlement and area and county and courtroom to one to another. One of his, I thought, very descriptive quotes is this. By the way, I put out a little handout there. I'm not going to really refer to much, just for your benefit. There's some really good reads about all three of them that I listed, the favorite ones that I found, as well as some of them, the fun quotes. But here's a quote. This is from Doniphan describing his life traveling as an attorney here. He says, "Many charming pictures float through my grateful memory of sights enjoyed in the humble homes of the early frontiersmen. Nearing the close of a weary day's travel on horseback, nothing was more cheering than the sight of the curling smoke of a cabin, with no fear of refusal, even to a stranger. Many asked me about General Jackson, who was then the president. We were not then a nation of readers. Few journals reached the countryside, hence the inquiries. It would have been unkind not to have gratified their patriotic anxiety, and I never failed to do so from my own limited store of reliable information. The rule was, horse well cared for, comfortable night, smoking breakfast, and nothing ever to pay. For 20 years after my arrival in Missouri, I do not remember paying a bill at any farmhouse." So thank you. Just basically you would go and you were welcomed in, fed, and taken care of. He was first elected into the Missouri State Legislature in 1836. So he's 28 years old, you know, when that happened. So a young man. 2 years later, 1838, one of his colleagues has a very young daughter who's very charming. And so he's going to marry her. She's going to get married on her 17th birthday. Okay, and he's 30 years old. He loved his wife, Elizabeth, dearly. He was always very devoted, faithful husband throughout his life, and in fact, one of the great difficulties for him is in later years is she passed before he did, and that was a great tragedy in his life. They had 2 sons, John and Alexander Jr. As I mentioned, both of them tragically died when they were 18. So John One evening, is he's in college, is feeling sick, and he gets up and he thinks he's going to go get some Epsom salts, is what he was looking for. He thought that was going to be good for his digestive. Instead, he mistakenly takes a bottle of mercury chloride, which poisons him, and he dies as a result of that. The other son, Alexander Jr., just a few years later, is also in college, and it's a rain, stormy season, and he and a buddy decide they're going to kind of dare each other to swim the river and get to the other side. His friend makes it. He didn't, and he drowns. And so they both of Alexander's children were lost. How did Alexander Doniphan cross paths with the Mormons? Okay, so it's the 1830s. It's 1831. For those of you familiar with early Mormon history, the Mormons were spread out essentially, most of them in either Ohio or Missouri at this point in time. And of course, Doniphan's in Missouri. This is his neck of the woods. He moved early from Kentucky after law school and spent the rest of his life pretty much in Missouri, either in Liberty or in Richmond. And his first acquaintance with the Mormons was in 1831. He needed a suit made, and he went to a man by the name of Peter Whitmer. Okay, Peter Whitmer is a well-known name to in Mormon circles. And Whitmer made him a suit, and he heard a little bit about them. Shortly thereafter, Joseph Smith and a number of church leaders came to his law office. And he was partners with a man who also was well-known in history by the name of David Acheson. And so Doniphan and Acheson had their law firm together, and they had a couple of other attorneys. And they agreed that they would defend Joseph and some of the other leaders who were being accused of a variety of different things. Overall, they were very successful in the fact that Joseph Smith was charged with many things, as some of you know, over the years, and was arrested many times, never convicted of anything. And most of it was trumped-up charges just because of people who didn't like the Mormons. But nonetheless, very quickly in Missouri especially, Doniphan and his partner Acheson became the go-to guys for the Mormon church. When the Mormons were being accused of something or whatever, they would often go. Now, this started to spin out of control, though, because this was Jackson County, Missouri, and there was a lot of folks in Jackson County who did not like the Mormons. And Doniphan wrote about that. So he said this. He said, "The real objections to the Mormons were their denunciation of slavery and the objections that slaveholders had to having so large a settlement of anti-slavery people in their midst, and also to their acquiring such a large amount of land. A very bitter feeling was engendered between the Mormons and the citizens of Missouri, which culminated in the month of July 1833, when a public meeting was held at the courthouse in Independence, at which it was resolved to tear down the Mormon printing establishment, the Evening and Morning Star, which resolve was immediately carried out. The mob also committed numerous other outrages, the most brutal of which was the tarring and feathering of Bishop Partridge." Okay, so this is Doniphan, a non-member, essentially writing about what had occurred. After that occurred, the Mormons went to him again for protection. Interesting exchange. So he agreed that he would continue to defend them against these attacks from the mobs and so forth, but that he and each of his three partners each needed to be paid $250, which was a lot of money in those days. Okay, $250 was a very high fee. Why was the fee so high? And he said, this is Doniphan, "We have been doing a practice here among these people to a considerable extent, and by this engagement, we expect to lose the greatest part of it." This was the clientele. Again, if he was going to side with the Mormons, this was the unpopular side. They were going to lose a bunch. And then he went on to say that if the fee was not agreeable, to please let him know. And he says, "We can be engaged on the opposite side in all probability. However, we prefer to bring your suits." And this is interesting why. This is the brave man here. He says, "As we have been threatened by the mob already, okay, and we wish to show them that we disregard their empty bravados." So he did go ahead. They did pay the money, Edward Partridge is actually the one who put up some of his land, essentially, to pay that fee. So it was a rough and tumble neighborhood there in Jackson County. Doniphan advised the members of the church to arm themselves and to defend themselves because he believed there would not be protection and that the law was not going to be effective. Nonetheless, as many of you know, the Latter-day Saints there were driven out of Jackson County, and they went into Clay County, and there was a lot of legal activities over several years, because what would happen is that he would bring lawsuits and on behalf of the church members who had lost properties, who'd had barns burned and things taken and so forth, trying to recover rights and properties and so forth. generally without a lot of effect. Atmosphere, even after they were expelled from Jackson County, continued to be extremely hostile in Missouri. Donovan's in the middle of it. So give you an example here. So there's a debate that happens in Jackson County as to whether or not they're going to allow any of them to come back. Okay, Donovan's there. There's a whole bunch of Missourians, no Mormon in sight. And one of the locals writes in his journal, a man by the name of Joseph Thorpe, and he says, he's talking about Donovan now and this meeting that occurs with all these Missourians. And he says, he, meaning Donovan, advocated the rights of citizens and individual liberty with individual responsibility, and he was opposed to, quote, Judge Lynch, close quote, and mob violence. He was in favor of law and order. The law was made for the punishment of evildoers and to protect the law abiding, and it should be strictly enforced. At this point, apparently, someone stood up and yelled, "The Mormons have lived long enough next door in Clay County. They must be either be cleared out or they could have to clear out." So they're going to do it by force. And then Donovan stands up and exclaims, "As the Mormons have armed themselves." Oh, by the way, this is when they heard that Zion's camp, this was a march where a bunch of Mormons were going to come from Kirtland, Ohio, essentially, were going to come and help restore their lands and stuff. So they heard that this army, this march of 500 was coming. Donovan says, "As the Mormons have armed themselves, if they don't fight you, they are cowards. I love to hear that they have brethren coming to their assistance. Greater love can no man show than he who lays down his life for his brother." At this point, apparently, people stood, pistols were cocked, knives were unsheathed, and right at that point, it looked like there was going to be a brawl with Donovan there in the middle. And at that moment, someone yelled from the outside, "A man has been stabbed." The entire room cleared to go see. Apparently, Donovan says that to the disappointment of many, it was not a Mormon who had been stabbed, but only two Missourians. And in any event, he escapes at that point without being, but you could see, again, a man who's going to stand up within the mob itself and argue and take him on. So in 1836, Donovan was the architect of Caldwell County, which was the idea of that was to create a county in northwestern Missouri where the Mormons could go by themselves. There was nobody there. They could have their own space and there wouldn't be a problem. That only went on for a while. 2 years later, in 1838, things explode in Missouri. There's what was called the Battle of Crooked River. This is where Edward Patton was killed, and there was a couple of other people, and the rumors flew that the Mormons were on the warpath, and that it was a massacre, even though it was Mormons who had been killed. And as a result, Governor Boggs, Governor Boggs of Missouri, issues his Mormon Extermination Order, October 27th, 1838, which says that the Mormons must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state. That order caused, of course, a number of things to happen, including all the militias in Missouri were called out to arms to enforce the order, to exterminate the Mormons or drive them from the state. Well, Donovan is a member of the militia. In fact, he's a brigadier general in the Missouri militia. And so he's called out, ordered by his governor, to go with a higher level general by the name of Samuel Lucas. And they're to march on Far West, which was the biggest Mormon settlement at the time, and they are to put down the supposed Mormon rebellion. Donovan went, and he, however, thought the extermination order was not only illegal and wrong, but that he was going to try to be a peacemaker. He was going to try to prevent bloodshed from happening. So he figured, if I'm there, if I'm the general, I'm better off trying to make something happen. So they march. They get to Far West, where the Mormons are armed. They're waiting for a battle. Lucas pitches his army with Donovan's troops outside, and they begin this little negotiation back and forth. As some of you may know, there was an individual there, a little infamous individual, by the name of George Hinkle, who is an officer of the Nauvoo Legion, but who is a traitor, essentially. And so he sells out Joseph Smith and tells him that they're going to go out and talk under a white flag with Lucas. Lucas knows that they're going to basically have who he wants delivered to him, and so he has his men swarm them, and Joseph Smith, his brother Hiram, and others are all arrested. And so then they march on Far West, and the people deliver up their arms voluntarily into the public square, at which point Lucas basically marches everybody out, puts the prisoners, holds a kangaroo court court-martial. The quote from Donovan is, "It was illegal as hell." Okay, because he says, first of all, you can't do a court-martial for civilians. And nonetheless, that was what Lucas does, and he decides that they're all guilty of treason. They all need to be killed and executed. And not being man enough to do it himself, he orders Donovan to do it. Okay, so here you have Donovan being told, and these are, of course, the men he has been representing, too, of course, in all these cases now for years. And so this was General Samuel Lucas's order. Quote, you will take Joseph Smith and the other prisoners into the public square of Far West and shoot them at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Close quote. How does Donovan respond? Famous words. Quote, it is cold-blooded murder and I will not obey your order. My brigade shall march for liberty tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And if you execute these men, I will hold you responsible before an earthly tribunal, so help me God. Now, Donovan was known far and wide for his integrity and being a man of his word. And when he said that and then turned and took his men and marched off, Lucas was in a quandary. If he goes ahead and shoots these men, he knows that Donovan's going to make good on his word, and he also knew what he was doing was illegal. Lucas doesn't have the guts to do that. So instead, he takes the prisoners and follows Donovan. They go to Liberty, and that's where then Joseph Smith and his cohorts are put into Liberty Jail, where they are for a lengthy amount of time. Donovan is immediately appointed as their lawyer. So after, you know, you've just had this military situation, and now you go back, and now Donovan is representing them again. He can't get a fair trial for months. Every time that he would bring witnesses in, he says that the witnesses were roughed up and driven out of town and basically forcibly removed. He said one time he got a witness sworn in and he was forcibly removed from the witness stand and so forth. There was a judge there by the name of Judge King who was quite the tyrant and who was determined to imprison the Mormon leaders. At one point, the judge, he did get a witness on, and the judge asks this question. He says, do you believe in the revelation of Daniel, the Old Testament, about the stone being cut out of the mountain with the without hands and then rolling forth and going forth? And the witness says, yes, it's going to go forth throughout the whole earth and smash in pieces all the kingdoms, which is, of course, what Daniel says. And the king and Judge King responds, he goes, that's enough, I've heard. This is clearly treason. Okay? Donovan's response was, Judge, you better put the whole Bible into treason. Okay? And so the prisoners, are there for many months, as some of you know, and the long and short of it was the prisoners eventually allowed to escape. And Donovan, at this point after the escape, speaks with Joseph Smith, who's now out of prison, and has an interesting discussion with him that's going to have some prophetic aspect to it. Right at this point, as they're talking, they're walking together, they're in Jackson County, and Donovan mentions that one of his clients, which was very common at the time, was going to pay him, offering to pay him with land. They didn't have cash, and so he said he was going to give him a piece of property there in Jackson County. This was Joseph Smith's response. Donovan, I advise you to not take that Jackson County land in payment of the debt. God's wrath hangs over Jackson County. God's people have been ruthlessly driven from it, and you will live to see the day when it will be visited by fire and sword. The Lord of hosts will sweep it with the bosom of destruction. The fields and farms and houses will be destroyed, and only the chimneys will be left to mark the desolation. Donovan did not take the land. Years goes by, and we'll get there in a moment here, but the Civil War takes place. And in 1863, Donovan, who's not fighting, who's still in Missouri, he moved to St. Louis, we'll talk about that in a moment. In 1863, he's visiting Jackson County to see some friends. And as he's going across from Liberty, he says that while they were riding over the entirely devastated Jackson County, which had just been leveled in the Civil War, that Donovan relates this prophecy, this incident, to his friend and says to him how the devastation forcibly reminded me of this remarkable prediction of the Mormon prophet. You know, so he recalls this again some 30 years later. Now, the situation at Liberty Jail did not end his legal representation of the Mormons. In fact, there was another very famous event that occurred with a different client. Some of you know who Orrin Porter Rockwell was. Orrin Porter Rockwell was one of the bodyguards for Joseph Smith, very rough and tumble frontiersman, was also an outstanding marksman, sharpshooter, would later go on in Utah to become a famous sheriff and law enforcement officer. A lot of great stories about Orrin Porter Rockwell, but this is one of them. So in 1843, somebody takes a shot at Governor Boggs, who was no longer governor, but is still on a lot of people's hit list. And somebody decides to try, and they shoot through his window at night, and they wound him. They graze his skull, and immediately everybody says, must be Orrin Porter Rockwell. You know, he's the kind of guy who would do that or whatever. Porter Rockwell's defense, by the way, to that was, well, you know, it wasn't me because I wouldn't have missed. But nonetheless, they arrest him and he's thrown into jail. He immediately demands that Doniphan be his attorney. Doniphan didn't want to be his attorney, but Doniphan agrees finally to do so. He's held without trial, witnesses, or any kind of bail or anything else for 9 months in very, very bad conditions. And there's a whole other story that goes with that. The interesting epilogue of that, though, is that at the end of 9 months, they finally get him to trial. There's no evidence at all that that it was him that shot at Boggs, and so he's acquitted, except that during the 9 months he had tried to escape at one point. And so they have a second charge for trying to escape jail. He's convicted on that. However, Doniphan gets the sentence reduced to 5 minutes in jail, at which point then Porter Rockwell goes free. Now, that was the end of really the legal representations that Doniphan does for people in the church. However, his personal history is just getting started, because at this point it's 1846, the Mexican-American War breaks out. And huge surge of patriotism, particularly out on the frontier. Everybody in Missouri is lining up to join. And there's a group called the 1st Missouri Mounted Volunteers. This tells you a little bit about Doniphan's character. You remember he was a brigadier general in the militia. Okay, he enlists as a private. His men in the volunteers immediately recognize and know who he is, immediately unanimously elect him to be their colonel. Okay, and they put him in charge. He marches, first of all, he marches all the way to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he's going to join General Kearney. That's also where the Mormon battalion crosses paths, and he writes about how he sees lots of old friends and people that he knew that were there in the Mormon battalion. That's where he would have met Kane, except that Thomas Kane is sick in winter quarters at the time. He leads his men. I'll go briefly because I want to get to Thomas Kane here. He puts down an uprising of Navajo Indians. He then takes a much longer march. He goes down to El Paso, Texas, where they have the Battle of El Brazito. He has 856 men with him. He's heavily outnumbered, but they take El Paso on Christmas Day, actually, in a matter of hours. Again, showing his capability. This is, again, a rough frontier time frame. He's got a lot of rough Missourians with him. He promises all of the people of El Paso, as soon as they take, he says, none of you will be harmed, and that I will preserve all of your liberty and your rights. He orders his men, you do not take one thing from any of these Mexican people unless you pay for it. Okay. Shortly thereafter, two of his sentries that are guarding the camp are caught falling asleep. Okay. Now, in wartime, that was capital punishment. I mean, that was the death penalty for something like that. Not Doniphan. Doniphan lectures them both on essentially the importance of what they were doing and so forth, admonishes them to never do it again and so forth, and then basically, you know, with a wrist slap, lets them go. Needless to say, his whole men loved him. They just thought he was the greatest thing ever. He marches then now another huge distance to Chihuahua, Mexico, where they have the Battle of Sacramento River. Very exciting battle. I don't have time to get into it, but just to give you a little thing, 4-1 odds. So there's four times more of the Mexican army than there is of the Missourians. The battle only lasts an hour. Okay, Doniphan, he was pretty good at war tactics. In fact, it's said that the tactics he used in the Mexican-American War are still taught today at West Point. And included a lot of things such as essentially, you know, holding your fire till it's kind of like Bunker Hill, hold your fire till you see the whites of the eyes and so forth. Don't waste your ammunition and everything else. And he practiced sharpshooting and a lot of other stuff. And anyway, long and short of it was, there was one Missourian killed and seven wounded on his side. There were 320 Mexicans killed, 560 wounded, and they took 72 prisoners as they took over the town. Finally, at the end of that, they sailed back to the United States. During the campaign, all of this time, he traveled 5,600 miles, okay, 5,600 miles, 3,600 of it by land, 2,000 by sea. It was said to be one of the largest distances of a military campaign since Alexander the Great. That was the news when it got back to the U.S. People started calling him, because he was a war hero now coming back, the American Xenophon. And Xenophon was the Greek fellow who marched 10,000 people across Persia over 1,000 miles. And so he picked that up. He not only got the hero's welcome, they even wrote a song called Alexander Doniphan's March. You know, so he was quite the war hero. Again, undoubtedly, this is something that Thomas Kane would have heard of as well. General Kearney called on him after the war, asked him to write the legal code for the new Mexico territory that had been was being acquired by the United States. So he wrote what was called the Kearney Code, and translated into Spanish as well as English. The Kearney Code is still used as a basis for a legal code in New Mexico today. At about this time, of course, there starts to have the rumblings of the Civil War. This was something he did not want. Although he was a Southerner and a slave owner himself, he wanted to gradually phase out slavery. He was of the moderate side. He was considered a Missouri moderate, essentially, because he was arguing essentially for the gradual reduction, not the immediate emancipation, because that would have been financially devastating to most of the slave owners, but to gradually eliminate slavery. He went to Washington, D.C. in 1861, right before Fort Sumter, to a huge peace conference. There's one of the quotes that I have in your handout there is his Union Man speech, where he says, this is on the last page, "I am a Union man. I go for the whole Union, the entire Union. I go for it north, south, east, and west. I do not intend to bring about a calamity that will destroy the border slave states and the whole Union." So whereas many of his Southern counterparts, and particularly Missouri, were advocating secession and to leave the Union, he was one who was supporting that it would continue. The war breaks out. He was very discouraged because he had tried very hard to push peace, and he was very distraught when the war broke out. Immediately, Missouri asks him to be a brigadier general in the Confederate Army. He refuses. Abraham Lincoln himself asked Doniphan to be a senior Union officer and to fight on the Union side. He refuses that as well. He was not going to fight on either side. He, however, removes himself and family to St. Louis. There's not a lot of information about why, but the speculation is that things were pretty hostile in Missouri, and somebody who was going to not fight, especially a war hero or whatever, that there were it was better for him to be out of town, essentially, during the war. Probably was a good thing, since Missouri, again, was devastated during the Civil War. He returned to Richmond after the war, after the railroad was built. The Golden Spike put in, essentially, so you could move across country a lot easier than with hand carts. He decides to take his travel to Salt Lake City. The last quote on the last page of the thing is from George A. Smith, again, who was a senior Mormon leader, and who says, because he got a hero's greeting when he came to Salt Lake City, "There are few men whose names have been identified with the history of our church with more pleasant feelings to its members than General Doniphan's. During a long career of persecution, abuse, and oppression, characters occasionally present themselves like stars of the first magnitude in defense of right, who are willing, notwithstanding the unpopularity that may attach to it, to stand up and protest against mob violence, murder, abuse, or the destruction of property and constitutional rights." It's interesting to hear what Doniphan himself had to say about the Mormons. So he, of course, notwithstanding, again, that he thought they were odd, never joined the church, was never a Mormon himself, but he considered them peaceable, sober, industrious, and law-abiding. Those are his words. He said regarding the Mormon leaders, Joseph Smith and others, quote, "I have never met a group of men who had native intelligence and understanding and force of character that have ever quite equaled the group of men, the leaders that were gathered around Joseph Smith." Close quote. There was a lot of accolades about him, some while he was alive, some afterwards. One came from one of the officers who served under him in the Mexican-American War. And this is quite a tribute to Doniphan. You think about the character here. He says, this is about Doniphan. "The man who can familiarize himself with the poorest private by some kind word, or ride among the troops and make us forget that we were hungry or thirsty by some pleasant conversation in our long and toilsome march, the man who can forget his own personal safety in the hour of danger and rise superior to every embarrassment, who can be prepared for every emergency by superior skill in the tactics of war, as well as a refined sense of honor, and an open suavity of manner not only leading captive the hearts of his entire command, but those of the hostile foe as well. Such a man is a treasure to society and to his country, and such a man is the brave Doniphan." There's quite a legacy of things involving Doniphan. For example, there's the town of Doniphan, Missouri, the county of Doniphan County, Kansas. There's a bronze bust of him in the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. There's a large a bronze statue, which I've seen in the town square in Richmond, Missouri. There's Doniphan Drive in El Paso, Texas. Alexander Doniphan Highway is across Missouri in Highway 152. There's an elementary school, Alexander Doniphan School in Missouri. And the governor of Missouri in 1994 declared that October 27th was going to be Alexander Doniphan Day in celebration of the time when he spared the life of the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith. So he has quite the legacy and was quite the gentleman. Let me switch to Thomas Kane. Thomas Kane was born in 1822 in Philadelphia. He was in a very wealthy and politically powerful family. His father, John Kane, was a politician, a businessman, later became a federal judge, very well connected. Kane himself would later say, "I was born with a golden spoon in my mouth." Okay. Again, he was only 5'4". He was sick his entire life. He basically was not physically well most of the time. He considered himself, in his own words, an invalid. He was trained as a lawyer. He traveled extensively throughout Europe and was educated there. This was important because he came back from his second trip to Europe, where he spent a few years over there, in his mind, enlightened as a reformer. He had talked to many of the different great philosophers and so forth and all, and he came back and he wanted to uphold a variety of human rights. And so Thomas Kane came back and started looking for causes to help. He was by birth a Jacksonian Democrat, that was his family, with a Presbyterian background, but he embraced neither ideology, and in fact was often an embarrassment to his family. He took up different causes they did not like. For example, anti-slavery abolitionism. They were, even though they were in the North, they were Democrat and they were very pro-slavery in those days. He was a huge proponent of women's rights, women's suffrage. Prisoners' rights. He fought against capital punishment, which was a very unpopular cause in those days. He also fought for the rights of Catholic immigrants who would come to the country, and the poor Catholics were often persecuted heavily. He was a great writer. He found out very quickly that if he wanted to advocate a position, write about it. And he would use the press. He would write both articles and op-eds and other things that he would sign, as well as send them in anonymously, and he would spread them out to different papers and make it look like there was a whole lots of people that were writing for these causes when it was really just him. He was very well-known and close friends with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Horace Greeley, other people that were human rights advocates. What was his contact with the Mormons? So he, May 13th, 1846, so this is right when the Mexican War is breaking out, in Philadelphia, he sees that there's a Mormon conference being held with a man by the name of Jesse Little, who had been appointed by Brigham Young to come to the East and to try to get support for the church, because the church at that point had been driven out of Nauvoo, and they were all scattered across Iowa, primarily in the Winter Quarters Council Bluff area. And so Jesse Little was trying to raise support. Thomas Kane hears about it, goes and hears him, impressed by the man, impressed by the suffering of the Latter-day Saints in the frontier, and he decides he's going to help. And so now you can picture this. You're Jesse Little. You've just come. Brigham Young said, go find somebody to help you. And so Thomas Kane comes in and says, basically, I have money, I have press, I have support, and by the way, I could introduce you to President Polk of the United States. Okay. Jesse Little likes that idea, and they do. And so he takes him in and he introduces him to the President of the United States, President Polk. Polk, listening to not Jesse Little, but Thomas Kane, son of John Kane and one of his big supporters and so forth, agrees to appoint John Kane, his father, to be a federal judge. At the time, by the way, another person he was very conversant with, the Secretary of State, is James Buchanan, who will later figure prominently in our story. And at the time he's Secretary of State, he'll later become president. But Kane persuades Polk that the LDS are still patriotic, that notwithstanding being driven out, that they're still on the side of the U.S., and he warns Polk, and he says, but if you don't friendship the Mormons, they might turn and they could go to the other side, into the Mexican side or whatever and so forth. So Polk thinks it's a smart thing, keep them in the loop and so forth. What do you want to do? He says, why don't we form a battalion of Mormons, essentially, to serve in Kearney's army? Okay, and Kearney, he already knows, is going to California. Now, at this point, Kane is not being completely altruistic, okay? Because he has a secondary thing. He wants to go to California. He would like to be the first governor of California. He sees what's going to happen. America's going to win the war. They're going to beat Mexico. They're going to get all this territory. Guess who's going to be the first governor? He's thinking this is a real plum position. So he's looking at that, and that's his plan. But Polk buys into it, and he gives him letters to take to Brigham Young to offer this, this and so forth. They send ahead a fellow by the name of Captain James Allen, who gets there ahead of Thomas Kane and Jesse Little. Allen is having no luck with the Mormons because they're suspicious. They think the federal government's out to get him again and so forth. And it's not until Kane shows up, goes and spends 3.5 hours with Brigham Young in private meeting. Then Brigham Young comes out and sells the whole idea to the congregation. Essentially, this is awesome. We're going to get paid in advance, $500. This will pay for all of us to go to Utah, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, Kane's promising to also help them with their settlements. He's going to the federal government and saying, can we get federal lands these people can settle on and be safe and so forth in Iowa to help them. Initially, things are going very well. The Mormon battalion is being raised. Things are going swimmingly. And in fact, it's kind of interesting to get Kane's take on this. So he, this is his first real experience with the Mormons, of course. And he says, he's writing home, and he says that I'm confined to a tent. Okay, this is in winter quarters. Okay, as the Mormon soldiers will give me no peace from their pleasant conversation for one instance if I step outside of my tent. Okay. And then he goes on, and he's somewhat joking, and of course, and then he says, poor as these people are, there is nothing too good for me, their guest. I dare not eat with them, because the little store of diet is brought out from my table, and quite a show of dainties appear upon my plate, while the good woman of her tent is munching on a crust of dry bread, supposedly out of preference. He has a frankly, kind of a conversion story there during winter quarters. He's going to be there for several months, and while he's there, amongst other things, Henry Boyle, a prominent member of the church, is walking with him in the woods. They're taking a walk, and they come upon a Mormon by himself out praying vocally in the woods. Okay, and the man apparently continues to pray, and they stand there over here. They take their hats off, and this is what Boyle writes. He says, I never listened to such a prayer, so contrite, so earnest and fervent, and so full of inspiration. We had involuntarily taken off our hats as though we were in a sacred presence. As Cain stood there, I could see the tears falling fast down his face while his bosom swelled with a fullness of emotion. And for some time after the man had arisen from his knees and walked away towards the encampment, the colonel, Cain, sobbed like a child and could not trust himself to utter a word. When finally he did get control of his feelings, his first words to me were, I am satisfied. Your people are solemn and terribly in earnest. So he's somewhat convinced now of the belief, at least the earnestness of their cause. But then he takes sick, deathly sick. In fact, he writes to his parents and says, I think I'm going to die. Okay, there's all kinds of sicknesses in winter quarters. One out of 12 people in winter quarters perish during the winter season there. He does not go with the Mormon battalion because he's so sick. And so he stays there, and he's being nursed back to health by the Mormons and so forth. He's given a blessing, which he calls a patriarchal blessing. This is from John Smith, who was Joseph Smith's uncle, who was the church patriarch at the time. In that blessing, amongst other things, John Smith promised Cain the following. A hair of your head will never fall from an enemy. Angels will defend you. Your name will be had in honor among the saints for all generations, and you will marry and have sons and daughters. He was a bachelor at the time. He was astounded at that last part of the promise. As a result, Thomas Cain, in his own words, left the Mormon camps a changed man. He tells Brigham Young as he's leaving, quote, I am spared by God for the labor of doing you, the Mormons, justice. And then he has the quote that I have written there also. He says, I believe that there is a crisis in the life of every man when he is called upon to decide seriously and permanently if he will die unto sin and live unto righteousness. And that till he has gone through this, he cannot fit himself for the inheritance of his higher humanity and become truly pure and truly strong to do the work of God, persevering unto the end. Such an event, I believe, too, was my visit to you. So he becomes dedicated now to go back east and to return and basically lobby for the betterment of the Mormons. This he does, and he will do this the rest of his life, actually, amongst the other things that he does. So for several years, he's focused on helping the Mormons, and they're going to Utah, and they're starting to get the wagon trains going and everything else out there. And then an interesting event happens in the U.S. that affects him greatly. 1850, there was a law passed called the Fugitive Slave Law. This was under the Democrat-controlled presidency at the time. And the idea of this was that if slaves escaped from the South to the North, the Northerners had to extradite them back, had to assist in helping the slaves be recaptured. Thomas Cain was so outraged by this. Okay, now, he basically caused a national event when this occurred. When this was announced, he was the reaction, and his reaction was this. He'd already been appointed by the President of the United States to be a clerk of the court for his father. His father's a federal judge, okay? He announces to the press and the world, I will refuse to uphold, I will not obey this law, and I will not enforce the law in this court. His dad, who's a popular Democrat, pro-slave, fellow, is so outraged that his son would do that out of his courtroom, he holds his son in contempt and puts him in jail. Okay. Shortly thereafter, it's only very short, the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, kick him out of jail. So the Supreme Court comes to his assistance against his dad. He had a great relationship with his dad, but it was volatile. Okay. Shortly thereafter, he marries his wife, Elizabeth. His wife is his 16-year-old second cousin. He's in his 30s. Interestingly, he was a member of a big proponent of women's rights. He believes that she's a very bright, educated young lady. He immediately encourages her to go to the first medical school in the United States that would admit women, which she does. And she becomes a doctor, and again, three of their children. He has three sons and a daughter. The prophecy fulfilled. He was very excited about that. And he encourages her to do that. She became a very educated and prolific writer and speaker herself. 1852, 2 years later now, things have been happening in Utah, and he's been monitoring this. So Brigham Young is there. He's the new territorial governor. And the U.S. keeps sending these federal officials, appointees, to go and keep watch on Brigham Young. Unfortunately, the people they send tend to be drunk alcoholics who want to have a bunch of mistresses and turn the Indians against the Mormons and do a whole lot of other things. And the Mormons will have none of it. And so those people then turn around and come running back, and then they make up a lot of stories about how their insurrection and rebellion and Brigham Young is a tyrant and so forth. And so there's this who's telling the truth situation. And so Kane is very adamant in the press defending the Mormons, reminding them about how they were driven out of these places in Nauvoo and Missouri before, and how these officials are corrupt, essentially. So he's taking that side, and he calls them runaway officials. That's his little title that he coins for them. And however, 1852, the Mormons come out and openly admit that they're practicing polygamy in Utah. Kane is appalled by this. I mean, he's a married man. He can't figure out how this has happened, but it doesn't change his loyalty to them. He doesn't believe in it. He's not Mormon himself, of course, but he still is going to defend their right to do what they want to do, and so he's going to defend them in that respect. However, the country as a whole goes into a bit of an uproar about that. In fact, the new Republican Party under Abraham Lincoln comes out with a position which says that the twin relics of barbarism are slavery and polygamy. Okay, and at the time, Buchanan has now become president. Buchanan has no love lost for the Canes, but he at the same time is looking for ways to bolster the Democrat side of things. This is 1857. This is just, again, right before the Civil War. Buchanan trying to avert all the headway that the Republicans are suddenly making about slavery, because they don't want to do anything with slavery, decides, well, I can attack polygamy. That's an easy target and stuff. So he decides to do so, and he gets encouraged. You got to put down the rebellion that's going on out there in Utah. You need an army. He thinks that's a great idea. This is going to get him great press. So he gets Alfred Johnston to form what is called Johnston's Army, 2,500 strong, and they're going to march across to Utah and put down the rebellion. They're going to throw Brigham Young out of office. And so the army begins marching towards Utah. Kane immediately alerts Brigham Young about this, as do a lot of other folks. And Brigham Young says, unlike the past situations that they dealt with, we're not leaving this time. And we will fight, and we will fight down, and we will, if we need be, burn down every Mormon settlement before we allow it to be occupied. And so they do a lot of things, including taking the temple foundation that they're building in Salt Lake City, and they bury it underground and so forth. He sends out a lot of Mormon scouting parties to harass the folks that are coming across the plains under the officership of Lot Smith. Many of you know a lot of the stories. They basically were told, don't kill anybody, but don't let the army get to Utah. And so what they start doing is attacking the wagon trains, burning the wagons, you know, running off the cattle and so forth. They don't kill anybody, although there's some shooting that goes on back and forth. And in the meantime, Thomas Kane is trying hard to get Buchanan to say, look, this is a mistake. You shouldn't be sending an army. And he meets with Buchanan. Okay, again, he's an adversary, but still he has this access to the U.S. president, okay? And he finally says to Buchanan, look, if I can, he goes, send me as a mediator. He goes, I'll be a mediator. He goes, if I can get Brigham Young to submit to federal authority, he says, will you, you know, basically call off the troops? Buchanan says, okay. He gives him letters that say, we will give you full presidential pardon, Brigham Young and all your people, and we'll promise that there will be no martial law imposed in Utah if you'll submit to federal authorities. So the problem, though, Kane realizes, is that to get to Utah, this is pre-railroad, that he's going to have to, first of all, go through pretty much the troops themselves, who are not going to like the fact that he's doing this, and there's all the Mormon scouting parties out there that they have no idea where they are or what they're doing, and he's worried he's going to be mistaken for one of the the Army or the Missourians and he could get shot. So he decides he's going to go the long way. So he takes a ship from New York to Panama, goes across the isthmus, takes another ship up to San Pedro in California, and then is going to take, he's met actually at that point by Porter Rockwell, who's going to take him into Utah. He almost gets killed in California when people realize who he is and what he's supposedly doing. So he decides to shift into a disguise mode, essentially, and he gets out of California without getting killed because people are very outraged about the Mormons and they have a vigilante party after him and so forth. Porter Rockwell gets him there, takes him immediately out to the campsite out on the plains. Now, what has happened at this point is you're in winter, okay? And so the army is stuck in the snow in Wyoming. They're near Fort Bridger. Fort Bridger had already been burned down by the Mormon scoutings. There's no supplies. There's no, you know, food or anything else. They're out there freezing, starving, hating the Mormons for putting them in this situation, but they're stuck. There's nothing they can do. And so Thomas Kane rides in by himself on a horse, okay? Initially, they think he's a Mormon spy. The army all wants to hang him. Johnston doesn't like him at all, thinks, again, he's there for the wrong purposes and so forth. And, in fact, Johnston puts him under house arrest in the camp. Kane, you know, prominent guy that he is and so forth, is so outraged at this that he does what any good, frontiersman would have done. He challenges him to a duel. He says, "You and me, Johnston," and he's, you know, he's gonna, we get our seconds and we put pistols and how many paces and so forth. Johnston backs off. No, that's not what I want to do. And meanwhile, Kane starts friendshipping Albert Cumming. Albert Cumming is the, Alfred, not Albert. Alfred Cumming is going to be the new governor to replace Brigham Young. But he seems to be a fairly decent guy, so Kane starts working on him and telling him essentially, look, the ones who went before you were telling you the wrong stuff and everything, and this is how you deal with the Mormons. You treat them well, you treat them with integrity, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, he starts going outside the camp and meeting Mormon scouts and sending messages and back and forth. The army that he's with hate him, okay? They think he's a traitor, they think he's a spy. At one point, there's an accidental shot at him that apparently grazes his collar, and they say, oops, sorry about that, you know? And in any event, he finally talks Cumming into going privately without any of the army with him to go meet Brigham Young. So Rockwell meets them. They go in a snowstorm. They get outside of Echo Canyon in Utah, and the snow stops, and Rockwell puts on a great display with Brigham's appreciation. They wanted to impress Cumming that if the army does come, they're ready for him. So what they do is they get the Mormon scouts up on the sides of the canyon on both sides, and they create bonfires, okay? And troops and everything else. And as Cumming slowly is taken down the canyon, the troops keep rotating down and firing more and more bonfires so that it looks like you have troops all the way down the canyon when, in fact, it's only two small groups that keep reappearing all the way down. But Cumming's duly impressed. He thinks the Mormons are very strong. They're armed. They're ready for us. This would be crazy to bring this army here. He's met by Brigham Young, who treats him like royalty. Brigham Young brings in the best LDS chef they've got, okay, and so forth. They showcase all the wrongdoings that the previous federal officials have been doing and tell him how they will not treat him at all like that way as long as he does what he's supposed to. Cumming basically is now on the side of peace and so forth. Kane writes back to Buchanan and says, I need a little bit more authority. Before he gets the authority, he goes ahead on his own as a mediator and says to Brigham Young, Buchanan will also agree that they will in no way interfere with your religion and they'll let Brigham Young continue to run the church if he steps aside and lets Cumming be the governor. Eventually, Buchanan reluctantly agrees to that. Peace is held. They bring in the troops, the army, essentially, who march into Salt Lake completely deserted, peacefully, out to a place outside, which they call Camp Floyd, which they remain at until the outbreak of the Civil War when they all remove the troops. But there's never any fighting. It's all resolved peacefully. Kane returns, this time across the plains, returns to the East. The East loves him, okay, because he's now settled this problem. He's been the big peacemaker. It's blown up in Buchanan's face. It becomes called Buchanan's blunder, essentially the Mormon War. And Kane is the hero, and Buchanan is the goat. And he continues to lobby for peace as the Civil War is about to break out. Civil War does break out. And unlike Doniphan, he immediately says, I need to be on the north side. I have to be on the side of abolitionism. So he goes to Pennsylvania. He gets a group together called the Bucktails, Pennsylvania Bucktails, who they call themselves Kane Rifles, okay, after him. They become a very storied regiment during the Civil War. They were sharpshooters. They were frontiersmen. He drilled them again and again on their abilities and practice. to where they became a very, very effective troop throughout the Civil War. Kane is up in the front of it. Kane is wounded twice. He's shot in the jaw. He's shot in the knee. He leaves for a time, takes a leave of absence from his command to go home to Pennsylvania to try to recover from his wounds. While he's there recovering, he gets word that General Robert Lee has brought an invasion from Northern Virginia into Pennsylvania, and that the that there's this campaign coming up. He decides he can't recover. He doesn't have time to convalesce any farther. He's got to go down and meet his troops. He goes in disguise as a civilian, slips through the Confederate lines, and he meets his troops in a place called Gettysburg in 1863, at which point his bucktails play a key role at one of the turning points in Gettysburg. There's a place called Culp Hill, which the Confederates were trying to take, and his troops hold them off against withering fire by the Confederates' onslaught for 7 hours and hold, and they don't give up their position. After Gettysburg, he's a war hero once again. So this guy's a rock star. I mean, he's settled the Utah War. He's a hero at Gettysburg and so forth. And so all the country knows his name. Undoubtedly, Doniphan would have heard of him. After the war, just to bring this to conclusion here, so he then spends throughout the 1870s and the 1880s in his latter years, he continues to lobby on behalf of the church. Why? Because at this point, once the war is over, the focus becomes again polygamy in Utah, and let's get this wiped out. And various laws are being passed, and Congress and the Supreme Court are doing different things and so forth. And so he's again on this writing campaign. He's trying to defend the saints there. He decides one way to do that is to take Brigham Young's invitation that now that the Golden Spike has been put in place and there's a railroad, he says, bring your wife and come to Utah. So he does. So he's got his, remember, doctor educated, very prolific writer herself, wife Elizabeth, who he brings to Utah. She and Kane are opposed to polygamy, and she thinks she's going to do a little expose. She's going to write on essentially how downtrodden the Mormon women are. I won't take time to read it, but she is completely changed when she actually meets with the women. She finds that they are unlike what she expected, that they're educated, they're intelligent, they're wise, they're independent, they're free, they can hold all types of jobs and offices, that they have better rights than most of the women in the rest of the United States. And she comes back essentially not converted to polygamy, but to the Mormon women. She wrote a book called 12 Mormon Homes, which then her husband helps publish all across the East to show that the Mormons are in fact very good, decent people. And she becomes an ardent supporter and defender of the Mormons as well, just like her husband. Thomas Kane was distraught in 1877 when he gets the news that his good friend Brigham Young has passed away. He immediately goes to Salt Lake again to assist John Taylor, who's the new Mormon prophet, in getting set up. At the time, there's great persecution against the Mormons there because of polygamy. And he helps John Taylor come up with the idea, some of you familiar with, of having a U.S. Supreme Court test case. A gentleman by the name of George Reynolds, who is a young polygamist, had two wives, and they're going to use him as a surrender him and use him as a test case. However, in 1883, before that is all resolved, Thomas Kane passes away in Kane, Pennsylvania. Some of the last words that he had on his deathbed, this is on Christmas Day, 1883, I believe I have this quote written there too, as he tells his wife in some of his parting thoughts, he says, "My mind is too heavy, but do send the sweetest message you can make up to all my Mormon friends, to all my dear Mormon friends." Right after he passes away, the Mormon Millennial Star publishes the following: "General Thomas L. Kane is dead. Hear it, ye saints, with bated breath. That long-tried friend, that brave and noble defender of the oppressed, no longer lives to plead with earthly potentates for liberty to the downtrodden, but has gone to plead before a higher tribunal." One of the many, many essays that were written about his life when he passes away was in Pennsylvania itself, and it said as follows: "This remarkable little man was always busy, always doing, always on the go. He was always ready to talk on religion, philosophy, politics, law, or business, with all the emphasis and courage of his strong convictions. That so positive a man was not always easy to get along with goes without saying. What he did himself, and he did it in his own way, but it was done on a broad and elevated plane, and there would be very much more accomplished in Pennsylvania if we had a few more men of the force of Thomas L. Kane." With his legacy, Thomas Kane has many things named after him, just like Doniphan was. There's Kanesville, Iowa; Kane, Pennsylvania, which has the memorial chapel that Gary mentioned; Kane County, Utah; the historic site where he's buried there in Kane, Pennsylvania is maintained by the LDS Church today. If you go to the Utah Capitol, you go into the rotunda there, there's a big bronze oversized statue of Thomas L. Kane. All it says is Thomas L. Kane, friend of the Mormons, which was really kind of his legacy. Both of these men were great men who, notwithstanding the fact that they had different views, different faiths, and did not believe in the religions that they were defending, stood up for the rights of the little guy, essentially, those who were oppressed. We can learn a lot today, especially with the extremes in our society, about standing up when things are unpopular for people who you may not agree with, but who deserve their own rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Small token as our appreciation. A couple of closing thoughts I had on that is, these guys weren't George Washingtons or Albert Einsteins or, you know, huge names for themselves. I mean, I'd never heard of them until recently. But that's kind of how we are. They did some great things, and we can do some great things in our own lives. And some of the integrity, stand up for those beliefs and stand up, for what we know is right. Which is really what this organization is about, is, promoting moral and ethical leadership, in the community and the world, in our little sphere of influence. So with that, we'll close, and we'll see you all next month.